Look at the natural world around you. Take a peek out the window, and what do you see? How long have things looked as they look today? 5 years? 20 years? Maybe you see a landscape that is unaltered. Unlikely. My name is Trevor Harris. I'm especially interested in Missouri's landscapes and their history. In a three-part series, I'll look at how Missourians, since the time of statehood in 1821, have altered and continue to influence our landscapes. Why a 200-year time frame? Well, it was almost 200 years ago that the Missouri Territory entered the Union. It was also almost 200 years ago that a young man named Henry Rose Schoolcraft set out on what would turn out to be a 900-mile walk that took 90 days. His Ozarks Journal of that trip is a trove of details about pre-European settlement vegetation and landscapes in the Ozarks. From Schoolcraft's journal and other writings, we have a good idea about what this place looked like before big box retail, superhighways, and exurban weekend retreats covered Missouri. In this series, you'll hear from a farmer and an archaeologist, a sawmill operator, and academics. There's voices of Missouri natives. They'll talk about what changes they've seen on our state's lands. We'll travel to Potosi, Missouri, where Schoolcraft's trip started, to West Plains, near where he crossed the North Fork of the White River, and to Springfield, where he said a man could get lost on his horse in the tall grass. Over the next few weeks, we'll learn about how logging and ranching have changed the face of Missouri's hills and hollers, and how they continue to be a viable livelihood for some. We start our trip in Potosi. It was here, in November of 1818, that Henry Rose Schoolcraft set out on a walk. This was no average walk. Schoolcraft and travel companion Levi Pettibone were looking for mining opportunities. At 25, Schoolcraft craved adventure that he wasn't getting in his father's Hudson River Valley glass plant back in New York State. It was a cool January afternoon when I huddled in Potosi's Washington County Library with three local history aficionados. Jerry Sansagraw likes to study and reenact the 18th century trapper and trader culture that set the stage for later American settlers in the Missouri Territory. Chris Richards is the editor of the Washington County newspaper, and Adam Marty. He moved to the area 15 years ago and is writing a book on the history of mining in Missouri's old lead belt. Jerry Sansagraw describes here how mines dot a reproduction map of Washington County that he brought to our meeting.
This is from, I believe it was 1888, from Frederick Wills. It was a map of Washington County. It shows all of the lead mines that were in place at the time, zinc, iron, copper, lead furnaces, zinc and iron furnaces, and sawmills. So you can see all the little marks here. These were all lead mines. You can see they dot the map everywhere. Everywhere you go, you'll see them.
No matter how old a map you can find, the lead belt is identified.
That's Chris Richards, Potosi native and co-editor of the Washington County Independent Journal.
Largest lead deposits in the world. There's always that reference. You know, the story was the guy that found the lead outcropping that supposedly led people to Breton Creek, which is where we're sitting at right now, that he saw something shiny while he was stuck in a tree because he was being chased by a bear. But he thought he found silver. Well, instead of being silver, it was lead. But at that time, everybody says now, oh, what a bummer. But at that time, that wasn't a bad thing because lead was very, very useful. Like Jerry has said, it's for shot, for, for cannonballs, for, yeah. I mean, it was so easily formed because of being a viable mineral and being able to do stuff with it, that it was really, really a valuable, mineral. And so that's part of what led the people here to this area.
Did the mines leave a visible mark?
Oh yeah,
that's called tiff cuts. That's what.
Yeah, the pits are everywhere. The tiff mining really left a lot of the ground tore up. That's when they started using the steam shovels and things. They would dig big portions of ground, and when they got done, they just leave it. So you see a lot of areas in here that's just dug up just because of the steam shovel, and they just left it. Brush grew up on it, and then that's the way you see it today.
Well, and one of the things that you'll find here too is any place that you've got a reasonable sized body of water is a tailings pond. That's what was left probably from a mill, right, from tiff, because they used water to wash the minerals to clean and separate the things.
Can you fish in them and swim in them safely?
Whenever you live in the largest lead district in the world, well, you've got lead. So, I mean, whenever all of the issues as far as lead came up, late 1970s, 80s, probably somewhere in that neighborhood, with lead in paint and lead in gas and all of the other things. You know, that's where all of that kind of took a turn, and everybody probably thought, well, we're not going to do anything about it because it's where we live, you know. But no, all of the ponds, bodies of water that I know of are used. We have one here just south of town that's actually developed. That's a pretty nice home development, and that lake is big enough that you can fish on it without any problem and use a pretty decent sized boat. But I think that going from that individual mining mode, as far as the French and the French being first, and having a shaft that was started out at ground level and went 15, 20 feet deep, and they used a windlass and rattle box, which these guys can tell you what those are. That's what Schoolcraft came to, was that early point on that. And I think that's where, you know, there was a hole here, and whenever somebody found something, they had a claim. And I think the description was they got it so many feet in each direction, and then their neighbor could have access, and they were limited that they couldn't dig horizontal. And, you know, that was kind of the rule of thumb, the way that it first started.
Traveling through the lead mining district near Potosi was hazardous. Henry Rowe Schoolcraft noted in his journal of Friday, November 6th, 1818, "Having completed the necessary preparations, I left Potosi at 3 o'clock p.m., accompanied by Mr. Levi Pettibone. Being both armed with guns and clothed and equipped in the manner of the hunter, and leading a pack horse who carried our baggage, consisting of skins to cover us at night, some provisions, an axe, a few cooking utensils, etc., on walking out of the village of Potosi on the southwest, we immediately commenced ascending a series of hills, which are the seat of the principal mines, winding along among pits, heaps of gravel and spars, and other rubbish constantly accumulating at the mines, where scarcely ground enough has been left undisturbed for the safe passage of the traveler, who is constantly kept in peril by unseen excavations and falling in pits. The surface of the mine hills is, in fact, completely perforated in all directions, although most of the pits have not been continued more than 20 or 30 feet below the surface, where the rock has opposed a barrier to the further progress of the miner. On reaching the summit of these hills, we turned to survey the beautiful prospect behind us, the Valley of Potosi, with its village and stream, the cultivated fields on its borders, the calcareous hills crowned with oaks beyond, with the distant furnaces smoking through the trees and the widespread ruins at our feet. A deep blue sky hung above us. The atmosphere was clear and pure, with a gentle breeze from the southwest, which, passing through the dried leaves of the trees, scattered them over the valley we had left and murmured a pensive farewell. We turned to pursue our way with such feelings as many travelers have experienced on turning their backs upon the comforts and endearments of life to encounter fatigue, hard fare, and danger." So wrote Henry Rowe Schoolcraft on Friday, November 6th, as he departed on what would become a 90-day, almost 900-mile walk across the interior of the Ozarks. My name's Trevor Harris. This is The Landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, a special series that looks at how Missourians and investors have altered our landscapes in the last 200 years. On a recent trip to Potosi, Missouri, I visited with Jerry Sansagraw, Adam Marty, and Chris Richards. I asked them about lead deposits beyond just Potosi in what's known as the Old Lead Belt.
Whenever you talk about we live in the Lead Belt, that's our area. You're talking from Mississippi River west, and you're what is now known as basically St. Francis County, Iron County, Washington County, that area. And you can look at it on a map, and it basically is a belt going across that little south central region. Because it was accessible, and it was easily accessible because being near the you know, top of the earth and being able to be found, that people could come in and you didn't have to have a great big enterprise to be able to mine it. You know, people lived off the land, and one of the stories that I was always told as a young guy was that the French were first. Well, the French just lived. They weren't worried about the enterprise and the industry. They were just living. Well, whenever it developed and it grew later on. Well, then you had these guys from the east that came that, well, they were going to make money off of this. I mean, this needs to be more of an industry. So that's where that all took a turn.
Mining is what drew many to Washington County in search of wealth. It also drew Henry Rose Schoolcraft to the area. He was interested in mining potential and in a possible position in Missouri's territorial and soon-to-be state government. Potosi, in 1818, was the place to be, not just for Easterners with big plans, but also French settlers, whose integrated approach to local life in the territory had helped them blend with the region's remaining Native American population. How did Potosi come to be the go-to place in the first decades of the 19th century in the Missouri Territory? Adam Marty knows, and he's writing a book about the region's mining history with lead and later tiff.
Lead mining began around 1723 in this region with Renault, and that was primarily French diggings at that time, and they smelted their lead in crude, what they called log furnaces, where they would build basically a stone box 5 foot by 5 foot. They would lay green logs across, pile the raw ore up to about a 500-pound charge on top of these horizontal logs, stack wood in around it and ignite it. They would burn it for 12 hours, roasting it up to the proper temperature. After 12 hours, they would cut the oxygen supply off and they would start reducing it down. After 12 more hours, they would open the furnace up and processed lead would run out the bottom of the furnace. That is what the French developed. At that time, it was mainly surface diggings, as Chris had said. It was all over the surface of the land in pieces up to hundreds of pounds. In 1864, the St. Joe Lead Company came into existence, and they purchased over in Bon Terre, Missouri, the Anthony LaGrave tract. Anthony LaGrave was tired of, during the Civil War, of having all of his lead works being constantly plundered by both the North and the South. St. Joe Lead purchased that property from him, and then they had surface diggings, and then 1869, the first underground shaft was dug in the region down into the lead deposits, and the activity of lead mining shifted from this region right here around Potosi in that time a little bit to the northeast in Bon Terre, and that grew into the largest lead mine in the world at its time.
Those first French that were just doing the digging here as a kind of a matter of convenience, that the lead was just laying there, were they just sort of digging into the side of the hill to unearth the pieces of lead that they could see and then kind of go a little further till they ran out and then just keep moving down the stream?
It was all over the place. I mean, everywhere. The surface of the land was covered with lead. The subsurface was covered with lead. If you go just south of town, head up onto the hill, you can see these old pits all over the place. The county owns a park. Washington County has a park up there where you can see some of these early pits.
I picked up on that mention and suggested a field trip. I got in the truck with historian Jerry Sansagraw while Chris and Adam drove together to a hill above town. When you're in Potosi, Missouri, things feel older. That's because they are. Numerous buildings in town date to the early 19th century. As we drove up a hill behind town, Jerry and I passed newer modular homes and 1990s vintage public housing. The pavement ended and the road turned to gravel. At a circle drive, we got out and met up with Chris and Adam for a walk across a Washington County park. More accurately, the Washington County Park, the only parkland that the county government owns. The land was mined by numerous companies over numerous years, and now the largely wooded tract remains undeveloped. Get out and walk through the trees, and you soon see reminders that mining used to be done here on a large scale.
Where are we now?
We're at the Deloge Park.
What happened here historically?
What happened historically? Well, mining,
just
I would
mining.
Say. This is the typical geography where you just got to ride across. So that was the typical geography that Schoolcraft would have been privy to, would have seen. And this right here is a first prime example of just exactly how I think the hills and valleys would be represented. And where we're going to head to is we're going to go to a couple of the open mining shafts that were still left from the mining, early mining.
Let's take a walk. Is this a city park?
County
this
park.
County. Oh, county.
Okay. And it was donated by the Deloge family. The original Deloge that lived here was Furman Deloge.
Furman Deloge.
And he actually came in around 1820, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he had a store here. But then he became involved in the mining industry. Deloge, Missouri is named for the family. Furman Deloge Hospital, that was in St. Louis, is named. They became philanthropists, you know, later on, and this was part of their original land grant, and they donated it to the county to develop as a park in memory of those miners that first settled this area.
The county has had this property for years and years, and the development of the park has never really taken place. It's been left as a natural area. So it's actually now being discussed as far as putting some trails in and actually making use of the acreage. So there's about 40 acres here, I believe. What we're looking at is just a random spot that was chosen to, we'll dig a few feet and see what we run into, see if we find anything. And that's how the prospecting was done, basically. It all based from what they actually saw on top of the ground. What we're standing in the middle of basically looks like some craters that you would kind of picture maybe on the moon or something like that, because you've got dips and little hollows as you go along. So, I mean, that's what you're going to run into as you go across this hillside.
Have they proven to be treacherous over time? They're not so deep someone's going to fall in them.
The majority of cuts are not. The majority of the shafts are not. They're, most of the shafts, if they played out, then they weren't left where they were dangerous. I mean, they were at least that conscious of their surroundings, because you didn't want to have somebody walk off into one that you left.
I find it up here once in a while.
And this is Tiff. What you're looking at, and for folks on the radio, TIF is a very heavy, very dense white mineral. It fractures and breaks easier. It's barite, and barite is used for medical purposes, barium. It's used as paint pigment, and then also used as a lubricant in oil well drilling.
Did the TIF get played out in Potosi, or did it become uneconomical to continue digging it here?
Uneconomical. It was a lot cheaper to dig elsewhere due to regulation and things. There was up until what year did Sinbar close down? We had a barite processing plant here up until just a few years ago, but they brought barite in from elsewhere in the world to process it here.
China.
They brought it from China.
And that was probably, I would say that was the late 80s that Sinbar went out probably.
Yeah,
Janet,
probably.
Janet,
well, no, it was later than that.
Well, no, Janet Adams was one of the last ones to work there, and then she became county clerk.
But I know when I went out there to get in there.
We're starting to talk about recent history. We won't agree on dates.
you can imagine these guys would be digging here, and it was a two-man operation. One guy was in the hole, and now they've slumped in and filled in. Some of these little shallow holes were probably much deeper. And they had one guy with a windlass, and a windlass is basically a piece of tree trunk with a hand crank on it with a rope and a bucket. One guy would be in the hole digging, putting the ore in the mud into this bucket. They'd haul it, and they have a thing called a rattle box, which basically is a box with a piece of sheet metal in the bottom with holes poked in it, and it worked like a rocking chair. And they would take all the mud and everything that they would dig, and they'd dump it in there, and they'd start rocking it back and forth, rattling it around to get the pieces of lead out.
Actually, that's part of the discussion that we're going through right now with the Deloge Park. They've set the boundaries. They know where the property lays, how it lays and stuff. And there's actually been a couple guys that have actually been walking the property and working on a trail. And part of the idea is to have it as a narrative, to be able to have a plaque here, have a plaque there. This is where you would have been. This is what was going on 200 years ago, you know, so on and so forth. So it could be pretty neat.
This is a special series, The Landscapes of Henry Rose Schoolcraft. I'm your host, Trevor Harris. Over the course of 3 episodes, we'll explore what our state looked like when the restless son of a glass factory owner walked 900 miles over 90 days in search of mining prospects. This episode features a history of one major modifier of landscapes, mining. Mines have largely left the old lead belt in 2016. Nearby Herculaneum does retain the largest active primary lead smelter in the nation, but with mines automation and their closing, the need for men to mine has disappeared. There are those around who recall the days when mining provided the area's primary employment. One of them is Anna Robart Pratt. She was born in Washington County into a family of miners. I met her this February at a rendezvous in Potosi. At a rendezvous, men, mostly, dress in buckskins and fur caps, just as French traders did 200 to 300 years ago. Since Pratt's arthritis hurt her hands, she was unable to bake bread in the stone oven, as she had done for many years before at the rendezvous. We sat down to discuss her memories of growing up around mining in Washington County.
I'm Anna M. Robart Pratt. My dad was Francis and Lena Robart. My mom was a Thibault. So we're strictly French, strictly French. They had 10 kids, raised 9. Hard times, 3 rooms, no water, no bathroom, just outdoor toilet. Took a bath in a wash tub, usually once a week. Walked to school, sometime crossing creeks, you know, to get to school. Well, now people go out of the town to work. Before, it was like what my dad did was dig tiff. And if they had a good week, there might be enough money. But otherwise, there was no money. It was a good thing that the stores would give you credit. And they'd give you credit till the end of the week or till you sold a load of tiff to be able to pay for that. You know, I don't remember being hungry. We didn't have a variety of things to eat, but we had always had a garden. Dad always had a cow and a calf and hogs. So we had meat.
Chickens?
Chickens, always chickens. Chicken every Sunday. But otherwise, you know, we didn't have a variety, but we had plenty.
How do you keep connected with French culture now? I mean, you show up at the rendezvous.
Yes, but they don't speak French here.
Right.
There's no more French around. No, it's about gone. There was about 3 or 4 people that spoke French, but they're all gone now. Oh, yeah, they tell you about Dad. He had a blacksmith shop. He sharpened all the picks and put the handles in, the picks, if they needed handles, shovels, axes. The men would leave their picks outside his shop. And then sometime we'd work till 10 o'clock at night. I'd turn the blower. We had a blower. You'd have to keep the fire going. He'd stand me up on the side of it's like a pit where he had the fire, but he'd stand me up on the side of there, and I would turn the blower, and then he would heat this pick, and he'd done both sides. There was a flat side, and there was a pointed side. And then he would after it got hot, red hot, he would put it out. I just can remember that. Bang, 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 bang. Bang, 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 bang. And then after he'd get the one side done, it would go into the water. I can just hear all that yet. And then he'd do all the picks that was out there, put them back in their handles. And a lot of times if they were loose, he would take a piece of leather from a shoe, like the tongue of the shoe, put that in there to tighten that up, so it wouldn't be loose when they would do their digging. Well, it was a nickel a pick. Sometimes he didn't get paid, but he did it anyway. He knew they had to support their families too, you know, digging tiff.
That was Anna Robart Pratt reflecting on growing up in former mining culture that existed in Washington County, Missouri in the 1920s and 30s. As the mines closed in the 1930s and 40s, men were forced to find other work. This often required leaving the area. I asked my trio of local history experts about when and why mining ended. Adam Marty, Jerry Sansegraw, and Chris Richards are heard here.
What year do you think mining activity peaked, or what was the plateau?
With the decline for lead here in the Breton Creek Valley, was, what would you say, in the 1820s? It was already on the decline.
Started going down by then.
Yeah, about the 1820s.
I think by the 50s, though, it was pretty well out, you know. At that time, barite was starting to be mined, and after the Civil War. But I mean, there was some lead still going on, but, you know, the major big boom, like, was slowly falling off by then.
So as mining has gone away here, what has filled the void? What drives the economy in Washington County now?
Farming and timber. Farming and timber would be the two mainstays as far as modern day. A good section of what is now Washington County is actually Mark Twain National Forest, which is federal-owned property, of course. But the number one thing that you probably would find as far as enterprise would be, as far as agriculture, would be cattle farming, and then you have timber as far as lumber and timber sales. So that's probably, I would say, the two number one enterprises as far as the land is concerned.
You know, we've had a few small shoe factories and things like a lot of places have, but they went overseas, and, you know, a few small things like that. But they're all gone now, too, except they have a one place left. But as far as big enterprises like that, the Potosi hasn't ever had any.
In 2016, mining isn't a huge part of the local economy in Washington County. It is a big part of Washington County's history. It's each June that the city of Potosi welcomes alumni back to town when they hold the annual Austin Festival, an event named to honor Moses Austin, the local entrepreneur who drew Henry Rowe Schoolcraft to the area. This year's Austin Festival will be June 17th and 18th in Potosi. My thanks to Jerry Sansagraw, Chris Richards, Adam Marty, and Anna Robart Pratt for their time. In the next episode of this series, we head to the White River watershed. It was there that Schoolcraft noted large stands of native pine and white oak. Forces that have altered the landscape since Schoolcraft's walk through that area include agriculture and fire suppression. That's the topic in the next and second installment of this series brought to you by the Missouri Humanities Council, KBIA 91.3 FM in Columbia. I'm your host, Trevor Harris. Thanks for listening to the landscapes of Henry Rowe Schoolcraft.
Bang, 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 bang,